Join Sam and Will as they bring the Bible's stories to life through historical evidence and try not to feel out of place in a car garage, all while bringing you Under the Hood.
Welcome to Under the Hood. I'm your host, Will. I'm here alongside Sam. Sam, what are we talking about today?
Today we're going to be talking about the resurrection, and we're actually going to be unfolding this in two different parts. So in this episode, we're going to be talking about, like, how do you reason yourself to the fact that the resurrection happened? Like, you can look at the evidence, you can look at the circumstances, and be like, okay, the most plausible explanation is the resurrection from the dead. And then in our next episode, we're going to be talking about the aftermath of the resurrection. Like, when you look at what happens in the world in the immediate aftermath of Jesus' death and resurrection and ascension, it is radical how the world is turned upside down so quickly, which then begs the question, why? And the answer is there really was a resurrection, and people absolutely for certain believed that Jesus was raised from the dead.
And obviously this topic's a huge one because it is the resurrection of Jesus, and Paul writes, like, if the resurrection didn't happen, then all of this is for naught, so it's something that we need to deal with.
That's perfectly spot on. There was a guy, Yaroslav Pelikan, who says, if the resurrection did not happen, nothing else matters. And if the resurrection did happen, nothing else matters. And what he means by that is, like, you go through your life and you know, everything is just, you're storing up all your treasures and trinkets and everything else, and you're going through suffering and trials, and at the end of the day, the grave swallows it all, right?
Yeah.
And so if there is no resurrection, none of this matters. Like, why are we doing this? Everything is rendered meaningless. Everything is lost to the grave. All of your money, all your career, all your reputation. People are going to forget about you. Like, everything is rendered meaningless if there's nothing beyond the grave. But at the same time, if the resurrection is true, nothing else matters.
Yeah.
All these stresses that are thrown at you, all the defeats, all the darkness, all the things that go wrong in this world, if the resurrection is true, then all of it is going to be undone. Everything is going to be made right. As Jesus says in the Bible, behold, I make all things new. And so we can go through setbacks. We can confront the darkness knowing that light will triumph. And none of this in the ultimate scheme of things owns me or controls me or enslaves me, because at the end of the day, the resurrection wins.
That's a great place to start. So what do we into?
So we're going to start with the idea that right out of the gates, the early church is absolutely obsessed with the resurrection. Paul, when he's on trial, says that it is for the resurrection, it is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial before you today. You go and you look all through the early book of Acts, everybody's constantly talking about the resurrection. We make a big deal of the cross, and the cross is a very big deal. It is the ultimate expression of love, that greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. Jesus says that. That's the greatest form of love. But if there is no resurrection, then we just have a dead Messiah, and that love is going to be rendered utterly meaningless and powerless. So the early church understood, like, resurrection is the key. The hope of an afterlife is the absolute key. That's what differentiates our faith versus everything else. We believe that death doesn't have the final word over us. And so, like, what I wanted to do for this episode is to confront that and be like, okay, is it logical? Is it rational to believe in the resurrection? And so today what we're going to do is just hit on 12 reasons why that's rational. And I want to start here. If you were to lose someone close to you that you love. You know, I lost my mom a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
It is almost impossible for me to reconcile the idea that she's just gone.
Yeah.
That her soul and everything she was and all of her memories and everything that made her who she was nothing more than electric synapses and cells and molecules, and now she's just returning to the dust, and everything that was mom is no more and never will be again. Like, my mind fights against that. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine a day when I'm no more. I can't imagine there's going to be a day where I say my last goodbye to my wife, to my kids, and there will be no more. There's something inside. Like, we know that death comes. It's an enemy to us. But when it happens, there's something inside of us that is utterly allergic to it. We grieve. It hurts us. All going back to the beginning of humanity, all religions and all myths, it's always like, how do we fight this? How do we defeat this? Because there's something in our nature that looks at it as an outsider. It's an invader that's not supposed to be, right?
Yeah, that's interesting that funerals would be different if we're just like, oh, we all cease to exist when we die, and that's that.
Yeah, like, okay, good. They got cool. liberated. Yeah. No more life for them. Moving right along. But you don't see that. Death is an enemy, and we all know it. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 in the Bible says this, that God has put eternity into man's heart. We know that. We know that there has to be more than this. Why would we be given that instinct? It's like C.S. Lewis has a great quote that I'm probably going to butcher, but he says something like this, like when God gives a creature an instinct, there's always the ability to fulfill that instinct. Like a fish is made to swim, it just so happens there's water. A bird is made to fly, it just so happens they have wings and air. A baby is born wanting to nurse, well, it just so happens that there's a remedy for that. And you were made with this instinct that knows that this world was not your home, and this is not enough. There has to be more, and it just so happens that you were meant for another world. Like, that's born in you. And so that nature inside of us, we know there has to be more, that we know there has to be some sort of a resurrection, something beyond this. So that's point number one, right?
Yep.
Point number two is there's more to this world than just the material.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we want to say, oh, prove it to me. You know, we want to be able to touch it and measure it and analyze it and everything else. And if it's not material, if we can't examine it, then it must not exist. And so that's one of the reasons why when you hear somebody talk about the resurrection, whether it's of Jesus or whether it's our own resurrection spiritually or physically later on, this world that has become so myopic in the material, can't imagine it. Like, yeah. we're like, oh, well, we can't measure it, so it must not be true. But the reality is there are things that we can look at in this regard about the soul. And one of them would be the record of near-death experiences.
Hmm.
So you go back to 1740, and there was a doctor who writes on this way back then, and he's chronicling people who had died and then somehow come back to life. And then what's the report? You've heard these. Like, there was a crazy light, and I felt this incredible peace, and, you know, I saw loved ones. Here's what he writes. He says he reported that after having lost all external senses, the material, he saw such a pure and extreme light. Now, how is he seeing if he's outside of his body? He saw such an extreme and pure light that he thought he was in heaven, literally in the kingdom of the blessed. He remembered this sensation very well and affirmed that never in all of his life had he had a nicer moment. Other individuals of various ages and sexes reported a very similar sensation in the same circumstances. Well, back then, that was 1740. You're already starting to hear these stories, but they're few and far between because it's very rare that somebody codes, flatlines, and then comes back. But in 1960, guess what is popularized and spread all throughout the medical field?
No idea.
CPR.
No.
Well, what does CPR do?
Bring people back to life.
It takes somebody who's dead, and it brings them back. And so since 1960, when CPR became standardized medical practice, we've had more than 10,000 documented cases of near-death experiences.
Huh.
And they're stunning. I mean, you'll have doctors that are like, they were coded.
Yeah.
There was no brain activity. They were out for several minutes or more. And then they come back, and their stories are almost all similar. Some people suffer. Some people talk about a hellish, tormenting faith. Those are terrifying to hear. But some talk about this feeling of peace and a light and seeing relatives that they know or being in the presence of Jesus and then coming back. And they talk about, there were studies done, actually, where in one case, they looked at 1,122 near-death experience cases and found that 64.3% of the survivors claimed to have experienced profound upgrades in vision with comments like, colors were beyond any that I've ever seen. Everything seems so much more colorful and brighter than normal. But there's a common thread, like they all harmonize. And now you find places like Oxford and major institutions that are like, there's something going on here that we can't explain, that science can't explain, that they're now looking at it. And then you find stories of doctors that are just blown away, where they're doing surgery on somebody who has an out-of-body experience, can relay and recount a conversation that happens in a different room, or when a doctor spills food on himself in a cafeteria before coming to operate on them in the surgery room, or the fact that there's a tennis shoe on the ledge outside of the building that turned out to be true, or somebody who's undergoing surgery who refers to the doctor making bird motions because the doctor's trying to keep his hands clean, and so he's using his elbows to point around, and the person comes out of this and is like, what were you doing the chicken dance for? Like, and they're like, you could not have possibly known that.
Yeah.
Well, what explains that? Like, there has to be more than just the material. How are they seeing outside of their body? How are they hearing without ears? Those are things that science, the scientific and the medical community look at and go, I don't know.
Yeah, it's like the material world, but better. It's like, oh, I see colors, but I'm seeing colors I've never seen before.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a greater experience in that mode.
That's right. And with our physical bodies, you know, we can only process certain frequencies on, like, sound. We can only process certain frequencies. But what happens if our capacities are expanded? What sounds would we be able to hear?
Hmm.
If our sight is expanded, what colors would we be able to recognize? How much more is in store for us beyond this existence when the fallen world is shed away and we're brought into glory? Like, and all of these people who have these near-death experiences are radically transformed. So that, just to start, like, we know there has to be more. In our hearts, we know there's more. But then we see in practice with all of these near-death experiences, they're experiencing something more that no one can explain.
Yeah.
But now let's look at the resurrection of Jesus. Like, okay, if let's go back and look at the circumstances surrounding particularly his crucifixion, his burial, and his resurrection, and the most obvious evidence is no body's ever produced.
Yeah, that would have stopped this whole issue really quickly if Rome was just like, hey, we got him. We moved him.
That's it. Game over. Like, Christianity's over if they drag out the body and go clunk.
Yeah.
There's your Messiah. Nobody follows a dead Messiah,
right?
But they did not produce a body. So that's number three. Number four is the failure of all the alternative theories that are out there. And these are kind of comical, actually. So this is why all these alternative theories emerge. When you go through, and we're going to get into this episode in the next, when you go through, everybody really genuinely believed that Jesus had been risen from the dead. People were utterly convinced. They claimed to have seen it with their own eyes. And so what you don't find a lot of in historical writings is people saying, they made it up, they're all lying. Like, you don't find that. The skeptics of the ancient world that are referring to this says that they weren't caught up in a mass delusion or something, but they believed that they saw this. They believed that Jesus was raised from the dead. And so you had all these theories that came along that said, how can we explain this? And so here's the popular theories. Number one, the swoon theory. Have you heard of this one?
Yeah.
So this is, Jesus is on the cross, you know, he's mutilated, he's been flogged, which if you ever read up on what Roman flogging was like, it's brutal.
They're
it's
good
unbelievable.
At it.
Wow. And that he's on the cross and from blood loss or trauma or whatever, he passes out. They assume he's dead, and even though he's speared into the heart, he lives through that too. They take him down, they put him into the tomb, he wakes up, mutilated and weakened, and is strong enough to roll a two-ton stone out of the way and escape out of the tomb, so that when they come, it was like, oh, he really wasn't dead, and he escaped. That it's just crazy.
Yeah, unravel himself, you know, the whole process.
That's right. And he was still passed out when they were, you know, anointing him for burial and wrapping him up. All that's crazy. The next one is mass hallucination. And this was popular for a while. And what this is, because the Bible comes along and other sources and say he appeared to many people. Many people saw him, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was all a mass hallucination. Like, there was some kind of mass delusion or hypnosis or something that caused all of these people to genuinely believe that they saw him. But it was all just a mass hallucination, which you can't replicate. Like, that's insane-o world. The next one, and this one's comical, is that they buried him in the wrong tomb, right? So, like, Joseph of Arimathea, if you know the gospel story, Joseph of Arimathea goes to Pilate, says, can I take control of this body? Takes the body, buries it in his own tomb. They're weeping there, right? But when they go there on the third day, it was like they forgot which one. They go to the wrong tomb, and they open it. Now, oh, it's empty. Hooray, Jesus is risen. All the other stories of him appearing are lies. And Jesus' dead body's really in the tomb next door because they went to the wrong one. Like,
and again, Rome never is just like, well, you went to the wrong one. Let's show you his body
again. Because remember, the Bible says that Pilate's seal is on the tombstone. So the that rolled across the entrance. Like, so that's ridiculous. Another one is that the apostles came and stole the body. What's the problem with that?
They're not SEAL Team 6.
Yeah, that's right. They're not SEAL Team 6. So let me give you some details about what these burials involved. So the average stone, because we have some of these, like if we've been to Israel, we've seen some of these
tombs.
Just
drive by one, and it's on the roadside.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of cool to look at. But it's a huge cylindrical stone. It's a big circle, 6 feet tall, 1 foot thick, limestone, weighs roughly 2 tons or 4,000 pounds if it's an average one. This is Joseph of Arimathea, who's a very wealthy man, so you guess his tomb's probably higher
it's
end.
It's a big stone.
So it's going to be at probably at least 4,000 pounds. So the idea of Jesus being in the tomb, and by the way, what they would do is it's in a track, almost like a glass door or something. It's in a track, and then when it gets down in front, it drops into a divot, and it seals the tomb shut. So you need a group of people to lift this massive 4,000-pound stone and to push it out of the way. Well, Jesus all by himself with the swoon theory is not going
to... from the inside, yeah. Trying to roll it out.
It's ridiculous. But beyond that, listen to this. The Bible says that Pilate ordered a Roman custodia to guard the tomb. Now, we know that a custodia is between 4 and 16 Roman soldiers. And these guys don't play around.
Yeah.
There's a death penalty if they fall asleep on duty. There's a death penalty if they allow a prisoner to escape. So they are trained that they don't sit, they don't lay down, they stand guard. And so what this theory proposes, the stolen body theory, is that this group of fishermen come to the tomb, overtake this custodia, nobody ever mentions this, or the battle, or the fight, or anything else, and then they sneak the body away. That's utterly implausible. And so here's another thing that when I found this out, it changes the way I understand the resurrection. But when you imagine the resurrection, I don't know if you're the same as me, but I always imagine like the tomb is out in this field.
Yeah, just somewhere
out there. Far away from town. It's very remote, very rural. No, the tomb is really close to the walls of Jerusalem at this point. So if you look at a first century map of Jerusalem, the tomb of the Holy Sepulchre today is built over top of where the tomb of Jesus would have been, and it's right outside the walls. Less than a quarter mile away, you see the Tower of Fazel, where they would have had soldiers positioned overlooking everything. It's right next to the walls. People guarding the city on the walls would have had visual sight of this tomb. And oh, by the way, this is all happening at the Passover, which is when Jerusalem swells and all of these pilgrims come back from all of these different lands to Jerusalem and they camp out on the hillsides. There's no chance that the resurrection could happen without the Romans being aware of it.
Yeah.
And the people on the hillsides, witnesses, seeing it. No chance, because it's right there. It's right next to Herod's fortress. So then the question is, what does the Bible claim?
Yeah.
It claims exactly that. There were witnesses, that the soldiers did have to go back and report and make up excuses for why this happened. And so out of the gates, you see that to explain away the resurrection, particularly in light of what we're going to see later, it doesn't work.
Yes, the whole idea that's just a pure myth that people are making up is crazy to think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's jump to number five. Ready? Here's number five in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. This is kind of this chapter is about the resurrection, and Paul is like, let me explain to you. Like, if you have trouble believing this, Jesus, after his resurrection, appeared to Cephas, which is Peter, then to the 12, then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time. So this is not like news spreading, you know. At one time, they were all like, yeah, we were there, we saw him, which fits with what we should expect here. He says, most of whom, this is important, most of whom are still alive. What does that mean?
You could go and talk to him.
Go talk to him.
Yeah, just go ask the guy.
Yeah, they saw it. By the way, tons of travelers from all over the world that were in Jerusalem, they saw it. There's probably people here in Rome or in Corinth or in Ephesus who were there who could vouch for this. And so go talk to them. They're still alive, though some have fallen asleep. And then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. And last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared to me also. And Paul's like, I've seen the risen Lord. And so you have testimonies of people that are all over the place. Then you have eyewitness accounts, number six, eyewitness accounts that are offered in the Gospels. So Luke, who is not one of the original apostles, but gets all of his stuff from Paul and Peter and others, puts together this account, he starts his gospel saying this, "Inasmuch as, hear this, many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished," what? "Among us." In other words, like, I'm writing to a community that's very well aware of this. They saw it. They know it. So now my job is I want to compile the narrative and make an orderly account of all the things that happened. And I'll tell you, Luke and the book of Acts, he writes both of them, the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts. He names people that are random people from different places, like Erastus and others, like where it's like a random name, but then you find ancient relics in those cities that confirm that, yeah, that was the director of public works here, and he's a methodical historian. And one guy, I love this, Sir William Ramsay, who is an Irish archaeologist, and he was trained up at Oxford. He was a skeptic. He decided to go on tour in all of these places like Turkey to see what Luke's claims were. And he started out being like, no chance.
Yeah.
Well, listen to what he says. He says, "Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, he's possessed of the true historic sense. In short, this author should be placed along with the greatest of historians." So much of our understanding of the first century, we can credit the Gospel of Luke with.
Hmm.
And what is he saying? I want to chronicle all of this with detail and so much accuracy. And then you get into the Gospels and he's spot on with all of this. Number seven, a surprise doctrine. Like, nobody in the first century, if you said, here comes the Messiah, nobody's expecting it to be anything like Jesus.
Yeah.
Not even close. What did they expect the Messiah to be?
I mean, they wanted someone to free them from Rome. They wanted a strong man to say, like, no, no more oppression here. My people are going to be set free right here, right now, on this earth, physically from Rome.
That's it. Like, he's going to come, and he's going to be a warrior king, and he's going to establish the temple and build it even better, and he's going to bring all the exiles back, and Israel is going to become this massive kingdom that dominates the world, and truth is going to reign, and peace and justice are going to be eternal, and they'll never fail because the prophecies say that that throne will be everlasting, right? So everybody's waiting for this Messiah that's going to come and bring about an everlasting kingdom, and Jesus comes and says, my kingdom's not of this world.
Hmm.
If you want to be my follower, take up your cross. Like, give away your wealth. Lay down your advantages for the sake of the poor and the downtrodden. Go love the Gentile. And everybody at that point who's expecting this sort of Messiah is like,
yeah,
this guy, he's a heretic. And they're certainly not expecting the Messiah to die.
Hmm.
They're not expecting a resurrection. And so for the New Testament to come and offer this surprise, nobody was expecting this, not even the apostles. So listen to this. This is also in the Gospel of Luke chapter 18. It says, taking the 12, Jesus said to them, they're on their way to Jerusalem where he's going to be crucified. And listen to how this goes. He says to them, we are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that's written about the Son of Man himself by the prophets will be accomplished, for he will be delivered over to the Gentiles. He will be mocked and shamefully treated and spit upon. And after flogging him, they will kill him. And on the third day, he will rise. And what's the next line? But they understood none of these things.
I love that about them.
They don't get it. Like, yeah. Messiah, he's not going to die. The anointed one who's coming to bring about the kingdom, he dies?
Yeah,
like,
that can't die.
He can't die. In fact, when they're coming to Jerusalem, you've got the apostles bickering over who gets to sit at his right and left-hand side when he comes into his glory, because they're expecting this to have lots of prestige and lots of power and lots of perks. And it turns out there's none of those in following Jesus, at least not yet. And so this is a huge surprise. Like, if you were writing something that would appeal to people, come to our team, is it going to be, hey, give up your life,
no.
Lay down your life, walk away from your money, walk away from your power, be willing to be persecuted, take up your cross? Like, that's not what the world wants to hear, yet that's what the gospel gives us.
And the only power to follow a religion like that is via if you believe in a resurrection. A supernatural resurrected Messiah is the only one that says, all right, I'll chase after that life now.
100%. So when we get into our next episode, when you see the impact of that belief in the resurrection, man, it's powerful. It is so, so powerful. And it should be powerful for us, too.
Yeah.
Sorry, here's reason number eight. Who controlled the burial and the tomb of Jesus.
Not the disciples, for sure.
Yeah, the disciples don't. But it's two guys that are listed. One of them owns the tomb.
Joseph.
Joseph of Arimathea. And he goes to Pilate and he says, hey, can I have the body of Jesus? I'll put him in my tomb. Who is Joseph of Arimathea? He is a member of the Sanhedrin.
Guys who wanted to kill Jesus.
The people who put him on trial. The people who wanted him dead, who delivered him over to Pilate. The ones who were incensed by him. That guy owns the tomb? Oh, and by the way, another guy that shows up to anoint his body and puts myrrh and aloes all over his body and I think was a genuine convert to Jesus, Nicodemus, also a member of the Sanhedrin. So now I want you to think about what the implications of that are. Mark 15:42, we're told Joseph of Arimathea was a respected member of the Sanhedrin, just so we can look this up. John 3:1, it says Nicodemus was a man of the Pharisees, a ruler of the Jews. So if these are the guys, then the Sanhedrin could not deny the crucifixion because they're naming their very own people. If this was all made up, the Sanhedrin can be like, there was no Nicodemus.
Yeah.
These are made up people. We've never had a Joseph of Arimathea, but guess what they couldn't do? They couldn't say those people didn't exist. They also, when they went to them and said, hey, Joseph, did you give your tomb to this guy? Guess what Joseph's going to say? I did.
Yeah.
When they go to Nicodemus and say, did you really bury this guy? Like, did you anoint him for burial? Did you wrap his body up? Did you put him in? Was he really dead? And guess what Nicodemus is going to say?
I did.
He was. Yeah, we did. So they can't deny the death. They can't deny the crucifixion. They can't deny the burial. They can't deny the location. And by the way, we know that Joseph of Arimathea goes to Pilate. So everybody's in the loop as to where Jesus is going to be buried, how he's buried, why he's buried, when he's buried. There's no deniability of this. And it would have been so easy for the early skeptics to be like, oh, that just happened a decade ago. Let's go talk to Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus and disprove it. And, you know, parade them out in front of everybody to be like, none of this happened, people. Here's the people they claim were the witnesses. They couldn't do that. Why? Because it was true.
Yeah.
Everything they were claiming was true. Next one, this will be controversial today. But they would have never, if you were making up this narrative, who would never be the first witness of the resurrection?
A woman.
Not a chance. Like the fact that the gospel comes and says Mary Magdalene. Because Peter and John go to the tomb. They see the empty tomb. They leave. Jesus then chooses to appear to Mary Magdalene. After they leave, which is an interesting thing, right? They would never do that if they were trying to convince the first century world. N.T. Wright, who's a brilliant guy, who's probably, like, of all people, he is the expert on the resurrection of Jesus, wrote a book called The Resurrection of the Son of God, and it's a massive book, hundreds of pages.
It's a tome, yeah.
Yeah, several hundred pages. But on page 607, he says this, women were simply not acceptable legal witnesses at the time. Like, they weren't allowed to testify in court. Nobody accepted their testimony. He says this, so if the gospel writers were inventing stories of Jesus' resurrection to convince others, they would never have had women be the first and primary witnesses.
Makes sense.
Right? Like, yeah. you wouldn't do that. So, but that's exactly what you find in the gospels. And you know what's funny? So Mary Magdalene is the first witnesses, and then other people see him and other people come along. But do you know what the early Roman world that's receiving the gospel, when they heard the gospel, do you know what they made fun of Christianity for? Precisely this. So one of the earliest skeptics is a guy named Celsus, and he writes, listen to this. He says, he's kind of poking fun. Ready? He says, so wait a minute. After death, he rose again and showed the marks of his punishment and how his hands had been pierced. But who saw this? A hysterical female. There it is. As you say, and perhaps some other one of those who were deluded by the same sorcery, which is an interesting comment, right?
Yeah.
Because he's like, one of these other people who was deluded by sorcery. What is he saying? They're not lying. They genuinely believe that there was a resurrection, but they are
deluded. And by some like magical sorcery.
Yeah, there's a lot of sorcery going on with that stuff over there because there's tons of stuff that we can't explain. The Babylonian Talmud, when it talks about the ministry of Jesus, doesn't say he was made up. No, he was real. They say he was crucified during Passover because he practiced sorcery and led Israel astray. Well, why would you say he practiced sorcery? Because he did what?
Magical things.
miraculous, magical things that nobody could explain. And so when the resurrection's going and all these people are claiming to have seen the risen Jesus and it's going around, the best that the Roman skeptic, the leader of the Roman skeptics, is the best argument he has is, yeah, a hysterical woman and a whole bunch of people that are deluded. They're crazy. It's all by sorcery. This is dark magic that has convinced all these people. That doesn't sound like a good argument. A much better argument, if they could make it, was he never existed.
Yeah.
He wasn't, you know, here's his dead body. But they couldn't make that argument. So that's number 9. Number 10, we know the key players that are confirmed in history. So like when you think of the crucifixion, you walk through the creeds that we cite. Who are the major players in the trial and conviction of Jesus to put him to death?
Pontius Pilate.
Pontius Pilate.
Caiaphas.
Caiaphas, the high priest, who's demanding crucify him, crucify him. Herod, he goes on trial before Herod at one point. Well, guess what? We know all of these people existed, and they reigned exactly at the right time during the reign of Tiberius. We have the Pilate stone that we found near the Mediterranean that lists his name, serving as the governor under Pontius Pilate. We found his signet ring by which he would have, like at the tomb, would have rolled into the wax to seal his authority over things. So we know Pilate, real character. We know Herod Antipas, real character. We found his stuff all over the place. But interestingly, we've also found the burial box that held the bones of the high priest of that time, Caiaphas. And when you look at this burial box, tremendously ornate. You knew this guy was powerful. You knew that he was very wealthy. And the box is inscribed with his name on it. Interesting.
Yeah.
Fascinating. You know, in the tomb, the same tomb where they found his ossuary box, they also found two nails of a crucified person with bone and flesh on it. And they don't know whose they were or why they were there. But it's just fascinating that next to the burial box of Caiaphas are two nails. Hmm. And it's like, I wonder what that is. It could be nothing, but I just find that fascinating. So we know all the key players are right. We know they're historical. We can prove their existence. But next, this is fascinating, and this is just recently, so I don't know what to make of this, but I do find it interesting. A few years ago, archaeologists were using ground-penetrating radar, and they were going to the place that we're almost certain was the place where Jesus was buried. So the way that we know that is after Jesus' burial, people used to go and venerate the site. When Constantine came around and the Roman world changed its perspective on Jesus, they built a shrine over top of the place where Jesus is buried, and it marked the spot, right? Well, this ground-penetrating radar goes to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which Constantine built over the spot, and they were looking underneath the floor, and this is what they found. These tests determined that the cave walls are, in fact, still standing at a height of 6 feet, connected to bedrock, behind marbled panels of the chamber at the center of Jerusalem's Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So they're looking down and they're like, okay, this wasn't just a random building. Like, there's really a tomb down there. Like, this is for real. There's definitely a tomb under here. There's a little open spot carved into this cave. And so they start digging and digging. And you know what they find? It's encased in marble.
Hmm.
Now, what they still have to do tests on is that the marble that Constantine put there?
Yeah.
Or is it the marble of somebody who would have been fantastically wealthy that could encase a tomb in marble? Can you think of somebody who's fantastically wealthy?
Our boy Joseph.
Our boy Joseph of Arimathea. Now here's where I think it gets even cooler. So they're like, oh my goodness, this could be real. Like, this could be an actual tomb. So now they go and they start doing the digging, and they're looking around at where they're digging up the floor of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and they find remnants of ancient plants. And they're like, this was a garden.
Hmm.
They find a variety of different types of fruit-bearing plants, and so now it's a garden. Why is that significant?
Because they say it's a garden tomb.
Yeah. The Gospel of John says that his tomb was in a garden. Now, when Jesus is raised from the dead and Mary comes to the tomb, finds the empty tomb, her first encounter with Jesus, she doesn't initially recognize him. Who does she think he is?
A gardener.
So wait a minute, there's a real tomb down there associated with somebody who's astronomically wealthy, surrounded by a garden, in the place that had been venerated from the early days of the church. And this was in the Jerusalem Post. I'll just read it. In addition to the botanical and geological findings, and by the way, the Jerusalem Post is no Christian paper. But in addition to the botanical and geological findings, researchers uncovered marble tombs on the church compound that appeared to be connected to Joseph of Arimathea, the biblical figure believed to have provided the burial plot for Jesus. The archaeologist Tesola said that she planned to test the marble tombs further to gain additional information about Jesus' death, and so we're waiting for those now. Fascinating. Hmm. Like, there's something there.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's going to be empty. So the last one that we'll do for this episode is the Judean tomb inscription. So Jesus comes along, and what is he saying? His whole ministry. I'm going to be crucified, and I'm going to be raised on the third day. And then he starts promising, like, I'm going to give you power. He goes to the city of Bethany, which is right over the Mount of Olives from Jerusalem, and it's there that he ascends into heaven and promises that he's going to come back, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Bethany becomes this incredibly holy site. Everybody believes that he's coming back from the east of Jerusalem, which is Bethany. And so an archaeologist, Charles Clement Gonneau, goes over there and starts digging up these burial plots, these massive tomb chambers that are filled with bone boxes. In 1873, he looks and he finds massive amounts of them. And it's names like Eliezer, which is the name Lazarus, Simon, Martha, all from Bethany. Those are names in the gospel, right? And a host of other things. And here's the thing, that dates to before 70 AD. In 70 AD, the Romans come and destroy everything. This is below that destruction layer. So it had to be within the first couple of decades after Jesus' death. But get this. Another guy goes near Bethany in the Mount of Olives and discovers a first century tomb, and it's packed with 100 bone boxes. And you know what's on them? Crosses.
Hmm.
And Cairo inscriptions. So what's Cairo? It's the Greek letters that form the beginning of the word Christ. It becomes the symbol of Christianity. It looks like a P with an X through it. You'll see it in religious stuff. That's on these bone boxes. You see devotional inscriptions to Yeshua. So in the first century, underneath a destruction layer of 70 AD, people are worshiping Jesus. They're putting his symbols on the boxes. This includes Gentiles, which means that would have been unthinkable, but Jesus opens up the kingdom to Gentiles. So you find Gentiles buried in there among the Jews. And this one, I think, is even more fascinating. When you go into one of them that was discovered in Jerusalem, it was under the city, so they couldn't just dig up the building.
Yeah.
So they have to go in, like, secretively. They use a robotic arm, and a guy named Dr. James Tabor, professor at UNC Charlotte, finds an ossuary box with these words, Divine Jehovah, raise up, raise up.
It's wild.
Which means they're buried believing what?
That Jesus is going to raise them again one day.
I'm going to be raised from the dead. Right next to that ossuary box, they find another ossuary box with the image scraped into it that features a fish swallowing a man. What does that make you think of in the Bible?
Jonah.
Jonah. What does Jesus say about his resurrection?
It's like a sign of Jonah.
Yeah, when the people are like, give us a sign, he says, no sign will be given to this adulterous generation except the sign of Jonah. For just as Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights, so must the Son of Man be in the belly of the earth for 3 days and three nights. And so these people that are putting on their bone boxes, Divine Jehovah, raise up, are also putting the sign of Jonah. And this is all beneath the destruction layer of 70 AD, which means right out of the gates, the people that are closest to the action in the very places where Jesus is crucified, dead, buried, risen, and ascended, those places are packed with burial boxes begging for God to do a power of resurrection for them. This isn't an organized religion that was mobilized centuries later by Constantine. All these burials happened before Mark even pens the gospel. Why would they do that?
They saw it.
Because they saw it. And so next time when we get into this, I think the more powerful argument is now let's look at the impact of what people began to do because they were utterly certain of the power of the resurrection, which is what our whole faith hinges on, right? Mm-hmm. Like if God has defeated death itself and he's overcome your sin and he's paid for all of it, what do you have to fear in this life?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Hmm.
You don't have to live as though you have an expiration date and you've got to frantically get it all together and live as though wealth is the ultimate objective or power or status and all that stuff, because death has been defeated and you've been granted an everlasting infinite inheritance by the Son of God. You are royalty in the courts of heaven. You are exalted. And this story is just beginning and will go on forever. So fretting about this mist and a vapor of a life that is here today and gone tomorrow is really foolish. Jesus has opened up the hope of an everlasting life with him where all things are made right. And that puts everything into perspective. And like we said at the beginning, if the resurrection isn't true, nothing else matters. But if the resurrection is true, nothing else matters. Amen?
Amen.
All right, well, we'll stop for there. I want to thank you for watching. Join us next time as we finish this series and get into more evidences of the resurrection.
Don't forget to like and subscribe. We'd love you checked out some other content we have. You can find that at sunlitstudios.com.